We're now recording. You're hearing it tell you that. So we're now recording. How many people do we now have? I can count 15. That includes me, though. No, I can't count. 19, but that includes me. So 19 minus me is what, 12? Right, Alanish? 18. Okay, so that's okay. So does everyone now have the handout? All right. Just a reminder that we don't have class Thursday. This is our one class this week. I am sorry that I can't be there in person. Not only that, the reason I can't be there is because I did not have a comfortable weekend, and I'm not fully recovered. It's no big deal. It was a combination of the bivalent booster plus some kind of food poisoning. We won't have class Thursday, then we will have class, I really, really hope, in person next Tuesday. So, okay, and let me just say that for those of you who still owe papers, it's still a plural. So no one should think, none of you who owe papers should think, OMG, I'm the only person who owes a paper, that's really terrible, what am I gonna do? My volume is all the way up. But that's not a, I think that's you. Next Tuesday is the Monday schedule. That's right. So we don't have class on Thursday, and then we don't have class next Tuesday. That's why it was important to mention that. Right. So this is going to be our last class till a week from Thursday. Thanks, Craig. Okay. Alanish, is that better? Did you manage to make me be less of a bellower? I hope. Oh, maybe she's got the volume turned all the way down now, so she can't even hear me asking her that. Is my volume all the way up? Oh, I misread. Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you much better.
Okay, I don't know why that is, but I'm glad. All right, so this is, so we won't meet again till a week from Thursday. That's right, right? Okay, so, which means that it's at some point we're gonna have to do, we'll do more of a change of pace. I know we did a change of pace in Paradise Lost, but we're still today gonna be talking about meter and the way some slightly more subtle stuff about meter and the way meter interacts, some more about the way meter interacts with, let's call it rhetoric, let's call it the rhetorical power of performance. So that when you're performing in your head, in your mind, when you're performing the sound of a line, when you're subvocalizing it, and this is just summarizing stuff we've already said, when you're subvocalizing, what you're doing is you are getting some of the importance of words from their meaning, in a sense that that has to be number one, is that the meaning of words in context is going to be the most important thing about a word. But sometimes the meaning of that word in context is going to be amplified and sometimes undercut by the metrical position that it's in within a line. What we've been talking about is iambic pentameter. I now want to say something that you should just have in the back of your mind, which is that, and it's something we've already said, but I want to be a little bit more explicit about, is the standard definition of iambic pentameter is that it's a basic beat that goes da 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 da. You know that's how it goes by this time now. So that's the basic beat. And we think of that beat as being, or we're taught, or we were taught back in the 20th century, that that beat was like a metronome. It's actually more subtle than that. And part of what we've been talking about here is how to talk about those subtleties. And partly, let me just add parenthetically that the reason that students and readers of poetry and poets are suspicious of iambic pentameter and don't know why they have to learn meter and they don't know what metrical poetry has going for it is a good reason, which is that iambic pentameter is only a really crude approximation of how meter works in English, how standard meter works in English. It's more a sort of relatively unsubtle check that you can do on whether something is metrical or not. It's like getting a digital thermometer that doesn't really work. You know how, I mean, all of us in the age of COVID went out and bought digital thermometers, and it was actually kind of interesting how different the results are depending on which thermometer you used, because they're actually not that accurate. So yeah, if you have 103 fever, you probably have a fever. If you have 97.1, you probably don't. If you have 99, the thermometer is going to say you don't, but you might worry about it because you might feel crappy. If you have 99.8, the thermometer might say you do, but you might actually think the thermometer is running high. So it's just a crude measure. And the importance of this crude measure is that it gives you a really basic background to see whether something is pretty much metrical or pretty much not metrical. It's also the case that different poets have different standards for what counts as metrical and what doesn't. And so part of what we've been doing in this class was that we started out with this, I didn't call it crude then, but with this crude idea of meter, alternating iambs. And then we started looking at ways that it got maybe more subtly harder to see the meter following a regular pattern. And there still is a regular pattern, but part of the question is the regular pattern, the regular background pattern, which you could say any line of poetry is going to dance around and dance with, sometimes dance with, sometimes dance around, whether the regular background pattern should be thought of as iambic pentameter or whether there's something more subtle than iambic pentameter to think of it as being. So here, there are reasons to do both. Here's the reason to think of, to think crudely, to go for a crude approximation. Iambic pentameter is really cool for the following reason, which is that you cannot divide a line into two equal parts that have the same meter. The reason for that is that we've talked about this a little bit, that in iambic pentameter, the first half of a line is going to go da 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 da. Those are the first five syllables. And the second five syllables are going to be da 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 da. So the fact that you can't divide a line into two symmetrical halves is a really good thing for poetry, because too much symmetry is monotonous, it's sing-song, it is something where people lose interest. But iambic pentameter will require variation in what happens in the first half of a line compared to what happens in the second half of a line. I'm looking at Craig's thing in the chat, and that's almost iambic pentameter. Next Tuesday is a Monday schedule. No, that would be iambic pentameter. Next Tuesday is a Monday schedule. No, so it's almost there. Okay, so everyone sees that if you divide a line into two halves, the rhythms of the two halves are going to be different. And that's really important. What that means is that iambic lines, even the most perfect, the most perfectly iambic, which is to say the most perhaps monotonously iambic lines, are going to divide at least into a shorter segment and a longer segment. So you might have the first four syllables will say one thing, and then the last six syllables will say something else. Or you might have the first six syllables will say one thing, and the last four syllables will say something else. But there will be an emphasis that will tend to flow towards the beginning of the line or towards the end of the line. It is really hard to get the line simply to balance right in the middle. And the fact that it's unbalanced is what keeps the poem going. Just the way we talked about terza rima, the fact that the middle line in that A, B, A, and then B, C, B, and then C, D, C form. Here we're talking about rhyme, but the fact that the middle line in each tercet is unrhymed pushes you on like a slinky going down a flight of stairs. It's restless. An iambic pentameter is restless in the same way. It won't just balance perfectly midline, and that fact that it won't balance perfectly midline is what keeps you going. You don't settle into a kind of boring stability. Iambic pentameter is an inherently unstable meter, and that is a feature and not a bug of iambic pentameter. To anticipate a little bit, this is true also of poetic forms like the sonnet. So the sonnet is 14 lines, which means it's how many, what is the most number of rhymes that you can get into a sonnet. It's 14 lines, sonnets rhyme. What's the most number of rhymes? If we say A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, etc. If you're doing the rhyme scheme of the sonnet, what's the highest letter you can get to?
14.
Not if you're doing letters, because if you have 14, you're saying you have 14 words, none of which rhyme with each other, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, yeah, so
seven. So, yeah, Massimo's right, it's seven.
Yeah, so seven is the absolute outside of the number of rhymes that you can have in a sonnet, assuming that each rhyme is paired with only one other. Most sonnets don't have seven different rhymes, depending on the sonnet form and their different sonnet forms. In Shakespeare, you have, do people know the form of a Shakespeare sonnet? Shakespearean sonnet? So that time of year thou mayest, just see if you can figure out from the first stanza, that time of year thou mayest in me behold. I'm gonna pause at the end of lines. So you can hear it. That time of year thou mayest in me behold, when yellow leaves or none or few do hang upon those boughs that shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. So, rhyme scheme? Okay, that time of year thou mayest in me behold. What would that be? That's A. When yellow leaves or none or few do hang. Anyone?
B.
Okay, good. Okay, people are saying it in the chat. Good. Upon those boughs that shake against the cold, we're back to A. Bare ruined choirs were late the sweet birds sang. So it's hang, sang, and behold, cold. Okay, so Shakespeare does have seven rhymes per sonnet because the Shakespearean sonnet goes A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, and then a final couplet, G, G. So that is A, B, C, D, E, F, G is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Petrarchan sonnets will rhyme something like, we're going to look at some of them, but there'll be stuff like A, B, B, A, B, B, A, C, D, E, C, D, E. So there'll be five different rhymes. Those are the two most common forms of sonnets. There are lots of other ones. But here what we notice is, all right, seven different rhymes in a Shakespearean sonnet, five different rhymes in a Petrarchan sonnet, generally. A thing to notice, and this may sound this is saying a lot on the basis of very little evidence, but it's not. Prime numbers. That is, there are a prime number of different rhyme pairs in a Shakespearean sonnet, namely seven. A prime number of different rhyme pairs in a Petrarchan sonnet, namely five. What that means is you can't even get symmetry in the rhymes. You can't have, like, if you had eight different rhymes, then you could go A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, H, G, H, and it would all be the same. But because it's a prime number, you cannot divide a sonnet into a symmetrical structure. So there, the rhymes are forcing asymmetry as well. The fact that a sonnet is 14 lines long means it's going to have an asymmetrical structure. Most of the great forms that English poetry is written in will have structures which force asymmetry. So that is, now we're talking about a general principle, which is that we are dealing with something that formally is going to be asymmetrical. People think that when you study poetic form, you're studying symmetry. Oh yeah, it's all going to be symmetrical. How boring. The whole point is it can't be symmetrical. How interesting. That's what makes poems interesting to poets who write in form. That's what makes poems interesting to readers who are reading formal poetry. How many syllables in a haiku? You all know this. Come on.
In a what?
17. In a haiku. How many?
17.
Yes. So not 13 and not 13 and not 17, but 17. See what I did there? Okay. So what does that mean about a haiku? It's three lines long, 17 syllables. Can it be symmetrical? Because 17 is a what kind of number? Okay, I'm reading your lips, Judy.
Odd. It's an odd number.
It's not only an odd number, it could be 21 syllables, and then you could get three seven-syllable lines, and that would be symmetrical, at least the three lines would be. But 17 is a prime number, so you can't have three lines that are the same length. You can have 5, 7, 5, which is standard. But if you take another 17 syllable form, you could say, okay, my form is going to have 16 syllables plus one syllable. But what you can't have is symmetrical. You can't have 8.5 syllables and then 8.5 syllables because it's a prime number. So this is not only true of English poetry. It is true of lots of different poetic forms that asymmetry is good. Anyone know what Catullus wrote in? Not not required for this course, but nevertheless interesting. He wrote in, anyone know? He wrote in what are called hendecasyllabics, which means 11 syllables per line. 11 is what kind of number? Okay. Again, I'm reading Judy's lips, a prime number. And yeah, and Preya is saying prime. Yeah. So the fact that it is 11 syllables means that a kind of almost automatic doing a poem by rote becomes impossible. It is asymmetry, prime numbers that can't be divided into equal portions prevent poems from just falling into a rote pattern. And that's a really important aspect of poetry. So that is something that we're going to see on the level of the line, on the level of the stanza, with some exceptions. And we're about to see an exception when we look at the Pope. Something that is what eventually will make free verse possible and will eventually make people recognize that free verse is poetry. That is, that what makes something poetry is the irregularity in or against a background of regularity. Prose is, you could say, irregular, but there's no background by which you can measure how irregular it is. What's interesting about poetry is that meter, which means to measure, which means measure, is that meter measures not regularity, but irregularity. And everything interesting about a poem is in its irregularity. So that's the thing to keep in mind. Ilanish, were you waving or were you raising your hand?
I was waving.
Okay. All right. There's a famous poem called Not Waving But Drowning, but I'm glad you weren't drowning. All right, so if you got out the file that I sent you with the reminder, which I hope you did, let us look at it, and we'll start by looking at the moment in Paradise Lost that we were already looking at. And here, and I want to look at this to give you one other thing to say about iambic pentameter, which is, having now said what's good about thinking of there being five iambic feet per line, I want to say what's wrong about that, and what in fact, actually at Brandeis, Brandeis used to be the center of the world in the really technical and intense linguistic study of poetry. The Brandeis Linguistics Department did probably the most important work on, from a technical, theoretical, scientific perspective, on the linguistics of poetic meter. That work is still absolutely central to people who study meter. So what they did, what linguists say about meter, I'm going to simplify a little bit, but only a little, is that it is wrong to think of a line as a unit that divides into five similar parts. It's much better to say that what we call a foot has two positions in it, a weak position and a strong position. The difference there, that might just sound like a fancy way of saying, yeah, unstressed, stressed. But the difference there is that what makes something unstressed is not the relation that it has to the syllable before it, but the relation that it has to the syllable that comes after it. So iambic pentameter, it's going to sound like you're going to say da 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 da, and all the does can be measured by the fact that they're less stressed than the stressed syllable that ended the previous foot. Does that make sense to people? I hope that was clear. I could imagine it being clear. I can imagine it being unclear. But what when people first learn meter, what they think is, okay, we look at an unstressed syllable, we look at a stressed syllable. Now another unstressed syllable, now another stressed syllable. That's wrong. We look at, let's call it a weak syllable, which is weak because it's followed by a strong syllable. Then we look at a weak syllable. It's not weak because it follows a strong syllable. It's weak because the next syllable will be stronger than it is. So it's always the next syllable that counts, not the previous syllable. Okay, do people see the difference there? Just nod enthusiastically if you see the difference. Enthusiastically. Like, wow, that rocks my world, kind of nod. Okay, yeah, all right. I'll take what I can get. All right, Alonish. He's giving a thumbs up to someone who's walking by. Okay, there are exceptions to this rule. And one exception is it does matter what syllable comes before a syllable only because if a syllable doesn't precede the syllable that we're talking about, then even in a weak position, you can have a strong syllable. Now that sounds like, what are you talking about? Either what are you talking about? That makes no sense because I can picture exactly what you're talking about, but all syllables are preceded by other syllables, or it can just be, that just sounds like gobbledygook. Put simply, the first syllable of a line isn't coming after another syllable before it in that line. And so it can be strong, even though it's usually in a weak position, it can be strong. So you can start a line with a troche and then follow it with an iamb. And that is something that is true of iambic pentameter. And the linguists who are trying to figure out iambic pentameter say, yeah, that's how the brain is structured. That if it's the beginning of a line, then the weakness of the weak syllable is not nearly as fundamental to the syllable as it is if it's not in the beginning of a line. So just for our purposes, what we need to know and what I think we've been concentrating on a fair amount in the course of the class. For our purposes, this is again the after great pain. Anyone finish the line? The Dickinson line, after great pain. How very sad. Okay. Have you all memorized the line from Total Recall? You know how much I hate this. Jingyi, you can do it. Look, you're muted. You can just say it. Move your lips.
No, here, how I'll much I one. Hate this fucking planet.
All right. Okay, so everyone remembers that line? You know how much I hate this fucking planet? So it would be a real tragedy if you didn't also remember the line from America's greatest poet, Emily Dickinson. After great pain, a formal feeling comes. Okay, and the reason we looked at that line, recall, is that after is trochaic. It's not after, it's after. So the first foot of that line is not an iamb, but a troche. And then the second foot of the line, great pain, is possibly iambic, but it feels a whole lot more like a spondy, two stressed syllables in a row. So after great pain, a formal feeling comes. And the reason to know that line, besides how great and deep and powerful a line it is, and what a great and deep and powerful poem it introduces. The reason to know that line is it's self-describing. That is, after the phrase great pain, what comes next in the line? A formal feeling comes. That is the feeling of iambic pentameter. So you get a disruption after great pain, and then you get the iambic form. A formal feeling comes. So it's not a joke, but you could say it's a very deep pun, that after the words great pain, a formal feeling comes. And that is a metaphor for the experience of the formal feeling that you have after great pain. So that line tells you a whole lot of what you need to know about how iambic pentameter works, or English meter works. It's okay to start with a troche, but as you get to the second half of the line, notice that that breaks down into two unequal parts. First 2 feet, two, primer composite. Are people saying in the chat? No.
Prime.
Prime, yes, the only even prime. So 2 feet followed by a formal feeling comes. How many feet? Three, because 2 + 3 = 5. Good. And so the line divides into the iambic pentameter line divides into a shorter first part, which is not iambic, and a longer second part, which is. So there again, you get that asymmetry, but the asymmetry really works. After great pain, a formal feeling comes. Keep that line, memorize that line, use that line as your password on places that will allow you to use passphrases, so that it's always there. You know, the way Signal always makes you re-enter your password so that you're sure that that you know it. They're kind of guiding you. They think they know better than you about what you can memorize. Do that with after great pain and formal feeling comes. That should be a line that stays with you. After great pain, a formal feeling comes, and it will tell you a whole lot of what you need to know about how iambic pentameter works. Okay, so let's look. I was going to start us out looking at a couple of passages from Milton, but let's start out by looking at the Pope, the essay on criticism, which is the last thing in the handout that I sent today. You may have it in another version as well. But so just to tell you what this is, Alexander Pope, do people know, have you seen the movie or at least heard of the movie starring Jim Carrey? Who's
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind?
Yes. And what do you notice? What do you notice about that line?
Oh, the eternal sunshine of the spotless mind
is
iambic pentameter.
It's iambic pentameter. Do people know how they managed to get such a good iambic pentameter line as the title?
It's from the poem by Alexander Pope.
Yes, good. Called, do you know what poem?
No.
It's a poem called Eloise to Abelard. And it's a great, great poem. One of his few great poems that isn't funny, but it's really, really moving. Yeah, so the title, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, comes from Pope. So just think, how many people have seen the movie? Okay, did you like it? Yeah, it makes me like Jim Carrey, which is sometimes hard to do given that he's an anti-vaxxer and everything. I don't know if he's still an anti-vaxxer, is he? Do people know? Or has he learned to stop it? Okay. So yeah, it's a great movie. It ends it ends with the great word okay. And the title comes from Pope. It's Charlie Kaufman, so it's not that surprising. Think about that line, eternal sunshine of the spotless mind. And I'll even put it in the chat so that it is available to us. So, first foot is what? Anyone? This is easy.
Etern.
Yeah, etern. So I am or not?
It's a trochee.
Is it?
Etern. I guess ter, so nah, yeah, I guess an I am.
Yes, it's yeah. Etern. It's not eternal. Eternal. Yeah. Right? Eternal. Sounds like a drug. Eternal, you will never be sad again. Take some eternal. But it's not eternal, it's eternal, right? So first thought is eter. That is an I am. You can see that it rhymes with deter, eter, right? Eter. And then the second foot is.
Null sun.
Yeah. So eter, null sun. Okay. Two perfect iams. No big deal. Pope does tend to write in perfect iams. The other thing to know about Pope, we'll talk about this, I hope, if we have time. I hope. We'll talk. The other thing about Pope, we'll talk of this, I hope, is that he was famous in the early 18th century for the fact that his rhymes were always perfect. That is, sometimes you get slant rhymes, sometimes you get rhymes which are less than perfect. Sometimes you don't get rhymes at all, like with Milton. Sometimes everyone knows, I think we talked about this, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry, and yeah, not so perfect. Pope's rhymes were always perfect, and what that means is Pope is actually a place that you can go to figure out how words were pronounced 300 years ago. Because if Pope rhymed two words, they were pronounced, the rhyme part were pronounced exactly the same way. So as an example, he rhymes the word devil with the word civil. For us, they don't rhyme. For Pope, they did. They were perfect rhymes. So it's really, he pronounced the word devil as divil, and that tells you something about how that word was pronounced in the early 18th century. Another thing you can learn, this is not Pope, this was actually, there are other people who will teach you this, but our word wind, like the wind is blowing, didn't used to be pronounced wind because it was always rhymed with words like kind and mind and find. So how is it pronounced?
Wind.
Yeah, I'm showing you, I'm winding my watch. Yeah. So that is kind of freaky if you think about a song in Shakespeare that goes, blow, blow, thou winter wind. It was actually blow, blow, thou winter wind. And no, you really want wind to be pronounced wind, but it wasn't in Shakespeare's day. Anyhow, how perfectly people were regarded, were admired for rhyming is really useful to people who are doing the history of pronunciation, which is what else would you want to devote your life to other than the history of pronunciation? So Pope was, Freya doesn't agree, Pope was famous for the perfection of his rhymes. So that's just something to mention by the by. So you have eter, null sun. What's the third foot?
shine of.
Yeah. So iambic or not?
I feel like neither of them.
Wait, say it again, Alexis.
I feel like neither of them have emphasis.
Okay, but it's weird that shine and of, that you wouldn't think shine, yeah, that's a lot more prominent than of. But it fits into the iambic line, eternal sunshine of the spotted mind, of the spotless mind. And it's interesting that it does. So that is the kind of thing to notice, that you, when things fit, and yet if you isolate them, they don't look like an I am. So it's eternal sunshine of the spotless mind. So that's no problem. The spotless mind, that's fine. But the shine of, that is a little bit unexpected. We've already started talking about moments like this. Now let's go to the, actually now in that case, let's go again to the Milton. And let's just look again at the passage we were looking at. Is this the region? So this is at the top of the thing that I sent out today. Is this the region, this the soil, the clime? And look at about 8 lines down. So it's farthest from him is best, whom reason hath equaled, force hath made supreme above his equals. Farewell, happy fields, where joy forever dwells. Hail, horrors, hail, infernal world, and thou, profoundest hell, receive thy new possessor. So look at the line, where joy forever dwells. So how iambic is that part? Where, should I put that in the chat too? Would that make it easier? I'm going to. So this is the line that we're looking at. Farewell, happy fields, where joy forever dwells. Okay. First foot. Anyone, say it and say whether it's iambic or not. You're just racking up so many points in heaven when you speak. God so admires you for speaking. So, okay, so Craig, is that iambic? Where joy?
No, actually, yeah, where's... I think so. I don't know.
Okay, say the line. Say it aloud.
Where joy?
Yeah, where, say the whole line.
Okay, where joy forever dwells.
Okay, so if you were saying where joy dwells, I don't know. I'm looking for joy. Do you know where she dwells? Where? I know joy, but where joy dwells, I don't know. Then you'd be emphasizing the where, right? But
yeah, so this is joy being emphasized.
Yeah. Hail, so farewell, happy fields, where joy forever dwells, right? It's pushing you to emphasize the joy. So that's where joy is. Joy is someplace different from where we are. So it is farewell, happy fields, where joy forever dwells. So what's the second foot?
Forever.
No, it's just forever.
Forever.
Right? It's you're gonna have to divide words.
Yeah.
Iambic pentameter requires you to divide words. Just because most two-syllable words are trochaic. If you're gonna put them in an iambic line, they're gonna be divided. So we're joy for Ev, right? We all agree. So everyone can hear that. We're joy. It's not as great a line as if you read it naturally, but all we're doing is exaggerating the natural reading. We're not going against it. So we're joy for Ev. Third foot?
Erdwells.
Yeah. So sound they sound like creatures out of Tolkien, the Erdwells. Or the Erdwells. Yeah, if you said the Erdwells, they would be trochies. But they're trolls, not trochies, so we call them Erdwells. Okay, so it's where joy for ever dwells. Then what comes next? Next foot. Not a foot.
Could almost, it be?
It's half hail, a foot, Alex.
Hail Hor. Like
yes. Yeah. Yeah. So it'd be Hail Hor. So where joy forever dwells, Hail Horrors. Hail. So what's happening there? Hail Hor. I am a trochee.
It's a trochee.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not Hail Horrors, Hail. Hail. It's Hail Horrors. Hail. So suddenly we get a trochee towards the end of the line, which is surprising. And yet the line works really well. Where joy forever dwells, Hail Horrors. Hail, infernal world. So why does that work? Remember what I said about the beginning of the line? That you could have, to give it its correct name, trochaic inversion at the beginning of a line, have a line start with a troche, like after great pain, a formal feeling comes.
So is it just because you're still ending on an upbeat or like an emphasized word?
So you're definitely, you mean with the second hail, right? Yeah. So you're definitely ending with a strong upbeat. Hail Horrors, hail infernal world. We can feel that this is what we talked about before, that that second hail is stronger than the first one. One reason that it's stronger is that part of our mind wants that first hail to be not emphasized. So the word, the meaning, the gesture, the rhetoric is tending to stress that word, but the meter is tending to de-stress it. And we get, it's still stressed, but less than it would otherwise be if we were reading it in prose. If we were reading it in prose, we would read it as something like, Hail Horrors, Hail Infernal World. But because it's the end of the line, we tend to read it more as Hail Horrors, Hail Infernal World. It's pushing us to stress the second hail rather than the first. But still, how does he get away with putting a troche? It's really rare that you have a troche in the fourth foot of a line. I'll just tell you that. This is not a frequent occurrence in English poetry. How come it works here? So remember what we said about the first foot of a line, how you could have trochaic inversion?
Maybe the same way you can have it in the beginning, you can have it at the end, like a trochaic inversion.
So generally not, but for some reason you can hear. So look at the line and see what that reason is.
Is it because it doesn't end with the troche and there's another iamb right after it?
Yeah, but generally that won't be enough. So there's something else that's making it possible here. Again, the hint is it's okay at the beginning of a line. That would be the hint.
The punctuation, the way it's like kind of starting the next line at the end of this line.
Exactly. Well, it's that you have the exclamation point after dwells. So farewell, happy fields where joy forever dwells. Boom. And then he's starting over because he's starting a new sentence. Hail horrors, hail infernal world. So it's the fact that it's a new sentence, that the previous sentence really ends with a bang. One way we know it ends with a bang is that we're going to another stress syllable right after it. So that fact means that the punctuation and grammar or syntax of the line is actually having an effect on what feels metrical to us. So all we're trying to do here is be explicit about something that we have a subliminal sense of and ask what gives us, what allows this to work subliminally when generally putting a troche in the fourth foot of an iambic pentameter line doesn't work. There's a line by John Keats that everyone agrees doesn't work metrically, which is, how many bards gild the lapses of time? And it's a good line, but the lapses of time at the end of the line, lapses of time, that's a troche followed by an iamb. And because there's no punctuation, it stands out to people. It doesn't, if you're reading a lot of iambic pentameter, that line is going to not sound like it belongs. It's, you know, if I just say it by itself, it may sound fine. But if you're reading, but if it appears in the midst of a whole lot of iambic pentameter, you're going to do a double take. And of course, the word you're doing a double take on is lapses, as though the iambic pentameter lapses at that moment. So that's Keats's little joke. How many bards gild the lapses of time? But there, it does stand out as not metrical. But here in Milton, it really doesn't. And that is a cool thing about the Milton. Okay, let's look at the Pope, which is in much more perfect form. Pope was absolutely insistent on metrical and rhythmical perfection. A lot of people don't like Pope when they first read him. He's an acquired taste because he's not like what we consider really great poetry, partly because he's so regular, but he really, really, really knows what he's doing. So this is from his poem called An Essay on Criticism. He wrote it at the age of 22, I think, or 23. Here he's writing in what are called heroic couplets. So just so you know the name of this form, the form is something called not only couplets, but heroic couplets. And what defines a heroic couplet, it was used for lots of stories about battles and people doing heroic things. That's why it gets the name. But what defines a heroic couplet is, as you can see, if you have the Pope in front of you, almost every line, here I think maybe, yeah, no, not quite, but almost every line ends with what? Every line rhymes. So if you're about to say rhyme, you'd be right. What else does every line end with?
Punctuation.
So this is called end-stopped poetry. And every couplet, or almost every couplet, is a standalone. That is, that the couplets function as a unit. You can quote any pair of couplets, and they will make sense if you're quoting them as couplets. Leave such to tune their old dull rhymes and know what's roundly smooth or languishingly slow. I'm just picking that up at random. Not so when swift Camilla scours the plain, flies o'er the unbending corn, and skims along the main. So this is, heroic couplets are actually among the hardest forms ever invented to write well in. Very easy to write badly in. Charles Darwin's grandfather, do people know about this? So I know that some of you are taking Morris's course, right? So Charles Darwin's grandfather was also a biologist, and he wrote a poem, which is his great work, about biology, and it's all written in heroic couplets. It's a really interesting poem, but not as a poem. It's interesting about biology. Erasmus Darwin. He was a huge influence on Chucky. But heroic couplets really are the hardest form to write in, and they seem the most boring, but if they're done well, and it's really hard to do them well, but if they're done well, they become really interesting. So Pope wrote this poem in which he's describing what poetry should be like, how to read poetry, how to think about poetry, and he does it as a poem. So it's going to be like After Great Pain, A Formal Feeling Comes. It's going to be what? What did I say all poems were? Oh, I'm going to have to give a very tiny list of the real take-home things you should always remember.
Self-explaining or something. Self-explaining is not the word, but it's...
Yes, or self-describing.
Self-describing, yeah.
Okay, so this poem is more self-describing than most. So he's saying most people get it wrong. He's complaining, and he says, but most by numbers judge a poet's song. So that's almost the same use of the word numbers. It's not quite, in fact, but it's almost the same use of the word numbers as when you say, oh yeah, he wrote this book by the numbers. That is, that it is just following well-known typical standards that you don't really have to think about. So numbers here actually means meter. That is it pentameter? Do we count to five? So, but most by numbers judge a poet's song. And he's saying these people are wrong, those who judge a poet's song by numbers. So he says, but most by numbers judge a poet's song, and smooth or rough with them is right or wrong. So is that a good iambic line? And smooth or rough with them is right or wrong? So yes or no, is that kind of line? All right, first foot is what?
It's smooth.
Yeah, okay, so and smooth. So is it and smooth or is it and smooth? And smooth would be a trochee, right? Wouldn't be English, but it would be a trochee. And smooth? Trochee or
iambic?
Okay. Or rough?
I am.
Okay, this is good practice. With them?
I am.
Is right?
I am.
Or wrong?
I am.
Okay, so perfect. Iambic line.
Yeah.
All right, so he's saying, look, you want most judge a poet's song by numbers. They want to know, is it perfect iambic pentameter? Here's one, and smooth or rough with them is right or wrong. What about the next line? Someone read it aloud. Again, you're storing up points in heaven. It's really good for you.
In the bright muse, though, thousand charms conspire.
Okay, so you were trying to make it a little bit iambic, and that was a little bit awkward. So what would be a non-awkward way of reading it? Just read it as a line.
In the bright muse, the thousand charms conspire.
Okay, good. So now we have in the bright muse, the thousand charms conspire. So notice then we have two unstressed syllables beginning the line in the. If one is more stressed than the other, it would be in the, not in the. The worst way to read this line would be in the bright muse, which you didn't do, Alexis, but you-
A little bit the first time.
Yeah, you were wondering whether you were supposed to.
Yeah.
But that's not how you would do it if you were reading it to yourself. So it's in the bright muse. So everyone hears the difference, right? What word really stands out as not conforming to iambic pentameter? So for a perfect iambic pentameter, it would be in the bright muse, though thou, but it's in the bright muse is the better way to read it. So what word is really the least conforming there?
Muse.
Well, muse should be stressed, right? So if it were...
right?
There are only four possibilities. I think it's bright.
Oh.
It's not in the bright muse, but in the bright muse. So what would we say about the word bright? It's self...
describing.
All right, good. It's self-describing. Yeah, the word bright is bright there. That's the point. In the bright muse, the thousand charms conspire, and then back to iambic pentameter, back to jog trotting iambic pentameter. Her voice is all these tuneful fools admire. So she's bright, but they don't care about that. All they care about is her voice. Is it iambic pentameter? All these tuneful fools admire, who haunt Parnassus, but to please their ear, not mend their minds. As some to church repair, that is, as some go to church, not for the doctrine, but the music there. So some go to church just to hear, music here is a bad word. It means just to hear the boring iteration of the easy rhythm, the easy meter of a hymn. So they don't care about anything intelligent, anything intellectual in church. They just want to hear the music. So her voice is all these tuneful fools admire, who haunt Parnassus, but to please their ear, not mend their minds, as some to church repair, not for the doctrine, but the music there. So here's a case, by the way, where we can see perfect rhymes that are no longer perfect. And I just want to point this out to you. It's a fact about heroic couplets that you sometimes get a triplet to vary the couplets. So here the rhyme is, and we wouldn't quite know it now, but ear, repair, and there were perfect rhymes for Pope. So those are three rhyming words in a row. And he probably would have pronounced it as something like, who haunt Parnassus, I'm not going to do the English accent, but who haunt Parnassus, but to please their ear, not mend their minds, as some to church repair, not for the doctrine, but the music there. So what he's doing there is suddenly giving you something which isn't just a couplet, but he's adding something on. So you do a little double take. And that's another way of getting variation. Then he goes on about these tuneful fools. Such a great phrase. You should use it as an insult sometime. You know, go hear a band that you think is terrible, and or start a band called the Tuneful Fools. That would be really cool. Maybe Jim Carrey would give you an endorsement. So these equal syllables alone require. So what does that mean? Again, it's Most by numbers judge a poet's song. These equal syllables alone require. They want each syllable in the line to be what? Equal to what? Equal to the underlying matrix. So what they really want is each syllable to be either unstressed or stressed, depending where it is in the line. So what do we think of these equal? Is that easy to say? Everyone try to say it. It's kind of, yeah. It works. It's doing what it's supposed to do. These equal syllables alone require. But there's something about the EE that makes it feel not so great. These equal syllables alone require. Maybe the equal syllable is a little bit of a tongue twistle. But definitely the these eek is technically correct, but not so lovely, let's say. Everybody, even if you don't go off mute, everybody recite the next line together on 3, 2, 1. Ready? That would mean taking the Stradium now. Do you all have it in front of you? Should I put it in the chat? I could put the whole poem in the chat. Would that make it easier? Would people like that? Okay, I'll do that. So, all right, I'll do from the start, just so it's all there in the chat. Oh, come on. I can't cut and paste into the chat. That's ridiculous. Of course I can. Maybe it's too long for the chat. All right, copy. And try one more time. Nope. I guess I'm going to have to do something shorter. I know you want me to share the screen, but no one pays attention to the shared screen. There's nothing like a shared screen to make people go pay attention to something else. Okay, I got some of it in the chat. It must have been too long for the chat. So on three, we'll do the first line. So 3, 2, 1, 0. Though oft the ear, the open
vowels tire.
Okay, so what's going on in that line? Why is that such a bad line? What makes it hard to say? All right, what's the first foot?
Though oft.
Yeah, okay, what's the second foot?
The ear.
Okay, so now you just put them together and you say, though oft the ear. Say it 10 times fast. All right, you won't, so I will. I guess that's my job. Though oft the ear, 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 though oft the ear. What is, I didn't do it 10 times, but still, what's wrong with that?
There's no punctuation.
There's no punctuation, but
it blends together.
Yeah. The oft. The ear.
The two O's.
First the two O's and then the two E's, right?
Yeah.
The oft, the ear. What do you think those vowels are called?
Open vowels.
Yeah, because they're not separated. Here, you said, Craig, was that you who said no punctuation? Yeah, no punctuation, but also a thing that kind of does a little bit of the work of punctuation is a little thing we like to call consonants. So if you have consonants, then you have more separation than if you have just a bunch of vowels slurring together. So the loft, the ear, the open vowels, tire. So there, her voice is all these tuneful fools admire. The loft, the ear, the open vowels, tire. Okay. While expletives, their feeble aid do join. So you may not know what an expletive is because it got misused by President Nixon to mean words like fucking in the phrase, you know how much I hate this fucking planet. And that then became famously expletive deleted. It would be, you know how much I hate this expletive deleted planet, but that's not what an expletive means. What do you think it does mean? Or what do you think the expletive in the line is?
Damn.
Say it again. Sorry.
Like, are you saying what you could switch it out for, or what it is like you know, in poetry?
I'm actually mean, what is it in linguistics? Mm. So, or in language. So, okay, if you're writing a poem, I'm sure you've all had this kind of trouble writing poems. Is that often you want to use the word love as a verb at the end of your line. And it wants to be something like, and that's what he loves, but you want it to rhyme with dove because you have that great original idea. But the problem is you want to talk about what he loves, but you want it to rhyme with dove. How do you do it? So how do you mess around with that so that it'll actually rhyme? Here is the person that he loves. He thinks of him as his only dove. All right, so fix that so it rhymes.
You have to either make one singular or the other plural. I forget which one was which already.
All right. Here is the person that he loves. He thinks of him as his only dove. So they're both singular. That's the problem. One of the interesting facts about English is that singular verbs end with S, whereas plural nouns end with S. So that's either a bug or a feature of English. So how would you get that to rhyme perfectly? There's an easy fix. Here is the person that he... Make it end with love. What do you have to do? Here is the person that he...
Can't help but love.
Okay, good. Can't help but love. That works. Even easier is here's the person that he does love. He thinks of him as his only dove. So just add the does there, and then the S is in the does instead of in the love, right? So that's a standard thing. You'll see this all the time in poetry and songs. So that does is called an expletive. It's something that is put in and that will change the form enough that will have enough of effect on the line that you can get a perfect rhyme. Okay, so what's the expletive in while expletives their feeble aid do join?
Do.
Yeah, it's not a word that you need if you were just being grammatical. You wouldn't say that in prose. While expletives their feeble aid do join. It's like Napoleon wants it to be the case that his army does join with Wellington. You would say just he wants it to be the case that his army joins with Wellington. So you can tell it's a poem because a stupid, unnecessary word like do is put in there. Why? So that it will rhyme. For Pope, join and line, again, were perfect rhymes. He pronounced the word join as actually jine. So while explet is their feeble aid, do jine, and 10 low words oft creep in one dull line. So why does he put the do in? So that you'll get iambic pentameter. Otherwise, it would be while expletives, their feeble aid, join. And that's not a good line. So by putting the do in, you make it iambic pentameter, but it's kind of feeble. So that line is self, what's the word?
Describing.
Yes. So while expletives is their feeble aid, do join. And 10 low words oft creep in one dull line. Quick, how many words in that line? It's iambic, a 10. Yes, iambic pentameter. It means there are 10 syllables. Every word is a one syllable word, so it has to be 10. Okay. Oh, good. Do you, oh, you probably see more of the chat, but no, maybe you don't. While they ring round the same unvaried chimes, so these are the bad poets. While they ring round the same unvaried chimes with sure returns of still expected. What are you expecting to rhyme with chimes?
Rhymes.
And what rhymes with chimes?
Rhymes.
Yeah, so while they ring round the same unvaried chimes with sure returns of still expected rhymes, where'er you find the cooling western breeze. What'll it do in the next line? It whispers through the trees. So notice the very thing that the cooling western breeze will do is what it does here. So where you find the cooling western breeze, in the next line, it whispers through the trees. So self-describing, but not in the way of the poems that he's criticizing, because in those poems, it's going to be something like, and then I sat within, or then I did enjoy the cooling western breeze and really loved how it whispered through the trees. But he's just saying, now, look, this is what you can expect. If crystal streams with pleasing murmurs creep, the reader's threatened, not in vain, with sleep. Because you know what the rhyme's going to be. Why is the threat not a vain one? If crystal streams with pleasing murmurs creep, the reader's threatened, not in vain, with sleep. What's the joke there?
It's boring.
Yeah, you're going to fall asleep before you even get to the rhyme. You're threatened with the word sleep, and it's going to be so boring that you're going to fall asleep. So again, a wonderfully self-describing line. Okay, we'll do a little bit more of this when we meet again in Thunder Lightning or in. Come on, last rhyme of the day. When shall we all meet again, in thunder, lightning, or in
rain?
All right, good. Okay, so have a good whatever off, at least from this class, till we do all meet again. Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.